It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kingsley, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations.
I'm Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the IU School of Medicine and Assistant Professor of Communication Studies at IUPUI.
And today's conversation is going to focus on the art of drone photography, perspective, visual storytelling, and the technical aspects of drone photography. Krista, we have with us today four special guests. We welcome Rocky Walls, the director and co-founder of 12 Stars Media. Welcome,
hey,
Rocky.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Great. And Joe Frank, your director of photography and a licensed drone pilot, also with 12 Stars. Welcome, Joe.
Yeah, good to be here. Thanks for having me.
And we've got Lauren Ann Christopher, associate professor, Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering, the Purdue School of Engineering and Technology at IUPUI. Welcome, Lauren.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And we have Paul DeAndrea, a professional photographer and also uses drone work in his photography. Welcome, Paul.
The deeper recesses when drones weren't common practice. Let me think here. I remember we held out for a while. Zach and I had conversations about whether or not we wanted to add drone work to our repertoire because there were, you know, a lot of concerns in the beginning. There's still concerns now, but we've had time to develop safety, you know, standards and licensing around it. But, you know, we wanted to. The idea of being able to get aerial shots without having to rent a chopper or do any of the other number of very expensive or difficult to set up things was appealing. And there were folks that went out and did it right just as soon as they could. And we held off for a little while. But, you know, the key for us has always been about making sure that we stay on top of really good quality storytelling. And for us at the beginning, that meant being patient and waiting to know when the right time was. And I think that patience paid off in some ways. I don't know how many years ago it was now, it all kind of runs together, but I remember having those conversations. It was fun, fun times. Joe, do you remember if, were you here yet at 12 Stars Media when we were having those conversations, or were we already sort of dabbling in drone work when you started?
No, I was here when we got the first drone, and I was I remember having conversations with you about that, about the regulations around it and things like that that were definitely not in place when drones became available to everyone. And so it was like, you know, we don't know, at some point the FAA may just decide that there's more rules that we don't know about, and then we could get in trouble. So it's kind of like, let's just wait it out. I also, from my perspective as a cinematographer, there was an explosion of drone videography as soon as they became available. And I mean, people were posting videos that were completely drone video, nothing else. And from my perspective, I was like, this isn't a real film. This is just a bunch of aerial shots. And so I had kind of a weird snobby aversion to drone work at first, because I was like, this is just what all the kids are doing, as you know, I'm like, you know, 25 or whatever. So that was also, from my perspective, I was like, not in a huge hurry to get into it. But then when we did actually get one, I enjoyed like the creative aspect of trying to find ways to work it into our films, that it wasn't just like flashy and just like, hey, look, here's a drone. We're just going to throw these drone shots in here because we have it. But using it to find interesting perspectives and things like that. So
I think that's so exciting to kind of think about, right? How folks' sort of perspectives and evolution of drones and drone photography and their utility have changed over time. And I'm wondering, Lauren, if this might be a good moment for you to jump in and talk a little bit about your research and how you've sort of seen this field change over time.
So when the drones first came out, there was a lot of the pilot had to do, right? And so what's happening as we go forward in time is that the automation is helping to give you the stability on the drone and also maybe some navigation through GPS or other means. And so there's a lot of work now in robotics area that's called SLAM, so simultaneous location and mapping. And so you can actually, if the drone is capable, you can add the SLAM technology that allows you to avoid obstacles and some of the other things that have been a little bit fearsome when you're close to the ground or close to people trying to take pictures. The thing you'd want to not do is run into them. And so there are technologies that are fast evolving now and really getting better and better. Now, one of the problems with a lot of these technologies is they have a pretty heavy footprint. So you got to have a really big computer or a lot of CPU power to do it. And so that takes more battery, more weight, more size. And so then you have to figure out how to do that on a smaller device. And so there are a lot of research right now is how to get the deep learning or some of these video concepts that you can use on the drone without being too heavy or too power hungry. So I'm hoping that, you know, I think there are a lot of shaking heads or a lot of nodding here on the Zoom call, but people were saying, yeah, this is the early pilots were having a lot more trouble, and the newer technologies are really helping the videographers get better control of the thing.
Paul, I know that you are very much like what Joe was saying, which you think of the whole package of photography when you're doing it. If you do a wedding shoot or you do a studio shoot, whatever you're doing, landscape. So you're thinking of it in also an artistic way. How does it affect you when you think of it? Is it another tool like another camera? How do you use that?
Yes, exactly. It's really, for me, it's almost like another lens. You know, it's a wide angle lens that I could put up in the air. I don't do a ton of drone photography in the same way they don't do a ton of super wide photos, but it's a great tool to have when I need a point of view that I can't get from the ground. So break out that drone, and they're amazing these days. The technology has really come a long way. Like Joe and Rocky, I kind of waited until the technology matured enough to really make it so that I didn't have to worry about the thing just flying off and never seeing it again. They're pretty brilliant these days.
I think that's to kind of piggyback off of that, Paul, I think you highlighted a really important aspect that maybe attributed to some of Joe's what he called snobby aversion, which I really liked that phrase. That was fun. That you're right. In a lot of ways, unless you're really, really, really either talented with the drone or really, really, really willing to take risk, you are kind of looking at wide shots and establishing shots. And frankly, for a lot of storytelling or even from a photography perspective, I know you as a photographer bring out moments with people very well, and that's something that you don't necessarily get from 100, yeah, 200 feet away. And so that's why when we think about a movie that we love, oftentimes we start with a wide shot, what's called an establishing shot. And then pretty quickly we start getting into more intimate scenes and action. And that's the one disadvantage that I think you have with a drone. And like you said, that's why you have all the other lenses.
Yeah. And early on, especially a lot of drones were using a GoPro as the camera, or the camera that was built into the drone was very wide angle. And that was also something for me that was like, I get the excitement around drones, but also like if you watch a movie that has aerial shots or a TV documentary or something like that uses aerial footage, most of the time it's not very wide. They usually do zoom in quite a bit. And you can do a lot of really interesting things with, you know, the motion and the parallax of having a telephoto lens zoomed in on something from so high up and far away. So there are interesting things they do with aerial photography that you really couldn't do with a drone at first. That has changed. I mean, the Mavic, DJI Mavic has one version that you can get that has a telephoto lens now. So you can get, and I think there are also probably adapters that you could add to the camera. So they've come a long way. And then the technology itself of the drone, Lauren, like you were saying, that the automation and the AI kind of aspect to things, it's gotten so much easier to, you know, you can pick up a point of interest and have the drone do a rotating shot around it. You don't have to touch the controls. Where if you try to do that yourself, it takes a lot of practice and a very steady hand on the controls to get that to look right. They've definitely come a long way, both with the photography aspect of it and the technology aspect. So
I'd like to ask if anybody's tried to fly it inside indoors.
I haven't.
Joe has.
Yes.
with varying levels of success, right?
Yes. Mostly success. Actually the first drone we got, we flew it inside a few times, even in somewhat smaller spaces, as long as we could, you know, make sure that we were keeping everybody far away from it. It can be a challenge. We've done it in like warehouses, like manufacturing areas. And it is really, I mean, that's a perspective that is really hard to get otherwise. We've gotten shots with drones inside places that, you know, it just wouldn't be in the video. We wouldn't have that type of shot, period, if it weren't for the drone.
Yeah, and the reason I'm asking is that Crane, the Navy base down in the south, has put forward a thing that that we're potentially going to be looking at as a grant to do reconnaissance, basically. So send drones into indoor spaces that may not have GPS, and then, you know, do the location and mapping and trying to understand what the space is before they send any people in.
Wow. And then, yeah, then you don't want to, you actually don't want to have it crash. So you've got, yeah.
You want to have it come back out. Yeah.
You want to have it come back out. You don't want the remnants in there. My wife and I were very excited this year. My daughter lives in Philadelphia, and Longwood Gardens is a really spectacular place. And they have a Christmas thing that they do every year indoors in this huge, huge conservatory, which is glass and warehouse size, Joe. So when you were talking about it this year, what they did, because people couldn't go, was they flew a drone through there with no people so they could fly it at people level as well as up. Oh my gosh, past all the lights and the flowers. It was as close. You know, it wasn't the same as being there, but in some ways it was better than being there because there were some perspectives. So I understand what you're saying. The use inside certain large spaces gives you something that you can't get in any other way. You know, a walking camera just doesn't do it because it's so narrow. Go ahead.
There are other uses that we've found, even just outside, shots that we could get with the drone that you could get with a regular camera, and a dolly or some type of stabilization, that would take a while to set up. Whereas the drone, you just fly it a couple feet off the ground and it's at like tripod level. And then you can just track along the ground, get, you know, wide shots of buildings, things like that. If you need exterior shots, I mean, that's huge. Like we walked around a school campus, a college campus, doing some promotional videos for them, and getting these shots that look like dolly shots that would, you know, be 10, 15, 20 foot dolly tracks that would take forever to set up. compared to what we were doing. And we were able to knock out tons of shots like that in a couple hours. So, I mean, that's been huge for us too. The Mavic 2 that we have, it kind of blew my mind when I realized, but the camera actually tilts up, which has not been possible with drones because of where the propellers are situated. But the Mavic, the way the camera is set with in relation to where the propellers are, you can actually tilt the camera up. And that, I mean, at that point, it's basically functions as a regular camera. And again, the imaging technology has gotten so good, that you can shoot in, you know, to get really nerdy, you can shoot in log, you know, 10 bit, the color space and color depth has gotten advanced enough that it looks pretty good side by side with our cinema cameras that we use. So it's gotten more and more seamless in that way. So that's been huge. So
I heard Joe kind of talk about some of the advantages of using drones for their work that they maybe hadn't considered, or that as the technology has changed, has sort of driven the way that they work differently. Have there been kind of lessons learned, either, you know, Paul or Rocky, maybe you can speak to this in terms of, we know that the drone technology can do these great things, but there are things that, you know, we just can't hire a drone to do. We need a human for that. So can you talk about maybe the dichotomy between those two things? Maybe Paul, we'll start with you.
Yeah, sure. A part of it is that the drone just requires some thought and setup and planning that you don't have to worry about with still cameras that you're just running around with. So, you know, if I'm doing event photos, I can strap on two cameras and really just be mobile and just zip across, you know, a big conference center from one end to the other and be up and shooting. Whereas with the drones, you know, you got to plan things out. You have to know where you are. There's, you know, airspace considerations you have to worry about. Setup, there's, you know, batteries on my cameras can last all day. The batteries on my drone last 12 or 14 or 15 minutes. And then I've got to be charging batteries and swapping them out. So you certainly get interesting perspectives with the drone, but it really requires a lot of thought and setup before you can really just start using it. They're a lot harder to just run and gun with.
That's great. Rocky, any other things that you want to add to that?
I mean, to reiterate that 100%, I mean, we're all as creatives facing, you know, we're always racing against the clock to some extent. I mean, I don't know a single creative that says, oh, I have unlimited time to document this in the way that I want. And so I think for all the advantages and all of the creative ways that something like drone technology can enhance our work, the flip side of that is, for us anyway, and I'm sure a lot of other creatives, is that, you know, you do have to be careful to kind of protect yourself from falling for it so much that it becomes like a bit of a gimmick. You're filling up a memory card full of aerial shots for a film, or Paul, you know, filling up a memory card full of a bunch of still shots that when you only maybe need 30 seconds or a minute one perfect shot. And so I think just like anything else, it's thinking, I mean, for us, it all goes back to like Paul said, the planning. I tell people all the time, you know, we're very strong advocates of the old adage, measure twice, cut once. And this is how you use a drone or any other tool for that matter is another perfect example of why that's so important.
It's a great point that, I mean, I even think about my undergraduate degree is in broadcasting from the early 90s, where I actually learned to physically cut tape with a razor blade, and then to move into, I see Rocky laughing, thank you. And then to, you know, move into a space where you do have, to some extent, some sense of, you know, unlimited resources, right? What I can store on my phone right now is, you know, what I could store on my one tiny portion of a hard drive when I was an undergraduate student. But that said, you know, time is a limited resource. And to some extent, when you talk about a drone, as Paul mentioned, battery life, right? That even though we have, you know, technology like this that helps us to really expand what is possible kind of from the commercial side, we also still have constraints in other ways that we've got to work within creatively.
Yeah, I think that plays to, you know, Mark and I have had endless discussions, I think, about the meeting of art and science. And that's a great example of that, I think, this idea that we have these very technical tools. We've got, like Lauren mentioned, you know, the AI component of this and the technology that's integrated is all a very, very science-y, very high-tech component that we're bringing into this. But ultimately, on the other side, ultimately the convergence of that technology with creativity, which I think you asked this a minute ago, where do you have the human involvement? Where is the part of the human brain that gets to apply that technology in a way that creates art? And I think that's the kind of the really fun part of it.
Right. And Lauren, I think that's true. As close as we can go to getting AI, it's the recognition that I might need to turn. You know, you can plan it out for the drone, but when you're seeing something on the spur of the moment, I would assume both Paul and Joe, that happens to you. You're seeing something through that, and all of a sudden you go, I'm turning there. That wasn't what I wanted to do, but it looks too cool, which I don't think the robot is going to be able to do, at least not for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, no. Right now the robots are basically doing path, you know, planning a path. And then avoiding obstacles, those are the two easiest things to do. But if you want to get a different direction of shot, the pilot or the videographer will have to figure out how to get the drone to do that. The other thing that's sort of interesting maybe into the future and sort of ask the creatives about this is as we get much better at taking data and using the drone to explore an environment, you could create a 3D model. I mean, your output could be a 3D model of some kind of built environment or outside environment. And then you could do, potentially you could do a lot of exploration in that 3D model in the, like you were playing a video game. So I see sort of television. We went from a flat screen, in some 3D, but there may be some long-term things where people can do more exploration and drive their own storytelling a little bit. So it stretches my mind a little bit of how you would do that in the creative space.
Yeah, interesting that you mentioned that. I know one of the projects that that Joe has worked on here at 12 Stars Media was actually in the Philippines. I don't know if what Lauren was just talking about brought this up. If you remember, they were using drones to 3D model a power plant in the Philippines. So taking images at, you know, I don't remember how many hundreds or thousands of images at specific intervals to completely rebuild. They call it a digital twin. In the power generation space, where we're literally recreating the actual physical power plant in a 3D modeling program using that drone technology. So it's pretty exciting. I wasn't there for that, but Joe, I remember, was flying a drone, taking video of drones taking pictures, 3D modeling a power plant.
Yeah, a little droneception there.
That's great. We've been talking with Rocky Walls, Joe Frank, Lauren Christopher, and Paul Andrea about the art of drone photography, perspective, and visual storytelling, as well as the technical aspects of drone photography. Please join us for more conversation after this break.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor, tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Krista Hoffman-Longton, and today we're talking about the art and science of drone photography. We've got some great guests, and I'd love to hear some of your perspectives about the idea of perspective with drone photography. One of the things for me that I think is really inspiring is about the extent to which a picture from a drone can create a perspective that you don't normally get from a traditional camera shot. And I'll just share with y'all that I grew up in the Chicago area, and Eames created this great video that many of us saw growing up called The Powers of 10, where it was this beautiful kind of connection between our sense of who we are in the world and just how small we are in the universe. And they did that by starting with a very tiny picture of a couple having a picnic in Grant Park, and they moved the camera up by powers of 10, sort of all the way into space. And it was, for me as a young person, what got me interested in the visual image, got me interested in broadcasting. And so I'd be interested to hear from some of our panelists, and Rocky, maybe we'll start with you, about kind of what perspectives do you think that you've seen or that you've used in your work that have changed the way that you've thought about a project or changed how you thought about what drones can bring to an audience?
Yeah, the biggest thing for me is just the ability that a shot like that often has to just immediately convey to a viewer that it's time to stop and think. Just kind of taking that, all of a sudden, if I'm watching something and then I'm way up in the air, and I don't have to be literally up in the air, but I'm really wide, and I'm not seeing any specific people doing anything. I'm not looking at faces anymore. It's like a processing time. And I really enjoy that. Some great films have ended that way, where it's just like a dolly or a chopper shot, I guess. Yeah, oftentimes, especially before drones, they were on a helicopter, just kind of leaving the scene and giving you that time to think. I think that's a really good way to use those wider shots. And so that's kind of the thing that I think of immediately.
Paul, do you have a favorite shot that you've taken that you think, certainly would not have been possible, or the story just wouldn't have been there without having a drone involved?
Yeah, when I first got my drone, I actually got it because we were going on a trip to Hawaii, and the DJI Mavic had come out, and it's a foldable drone. So there was finally a drone that I could actually fit in a small camera bag, pack it up and take it with us and just use it on the whole trip. And I've got these shots of my wife and kids swimming with sea turtles from right above them, looking straight down with them in the water, this beautiful blue Hawaiian water with sea turtles around. I mean, that's a shot that would be impossible to get. I really couldn't do it without a drone. I mean, you can use a helicopter, but yeah. And I was able to just drop that, unfold the drone within maybe 3 minutes. It was up in the air, out over the water, and able to capture that moment. It's pretty amazing technology.
And I think even listening to you tell that story, and like when I think about my story, it sort of speaks to the ability, as you said, Rocky, that these particular kinds of images have to evoke a kind of emotion, right? That there's something that you can get from that perspective that you can't get anywhere else. Joe, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think that the drone, it has opened up opportunities where, like I said before, like with being in a space where, there are perspectives that we literally would not be able to have, not even just up in the air, but just camera movements, things like that, that would be impossible given the amount of time that we have. And I think, Mark, like you were saying earlier, just that being the, using the technology as a human with a human perspective and putting that technology to use in a way that gives, that ends up with art, with like when I'm up with the drone and I'm looking at, a lot of times you just turn the drone a way that you weren't planning to. And it's like, holy cow, that's the shot right there. That's it. And that's happened multiple times. It's like, it's easy to almost become robotic when you're using the drone. Like there are certain types of shots that you just expect to get, and types of movements and things that are kind of easy to pull off, and it's easy to fall right into that. But then again, sometimes you just give yourself the time to play and and look around and make sure that you're getting the best perspective you can. And that's happened multiple times. I think probably one of my favorite shots that I've gotten, and I don't actually even know if it was used in the video we were shooting, but I was in the Philippines. We were on top of a mountain looking down into a volcano that was in this bay. And then on the other side of the volcano, there was another, like the mountains kind of continued on that way. And the sun was coming down, setting behind the opposite mountain range. And yeah, we took the drone kind of on a whim, and I pulled it out, and like Paul was saying, within, you know, 5 minutes, I was up in the air getting that sunset. And stuff like that is just, you can't manufacture that. You can't plan for that. It just happened, and it's great. So.
Can I ask a follow-up question to that? This is one of the things, as I have had the pleasure of working with Mark on this radio show, that I gain an incredible appreciation for. And Lauren, I'm wondering if maybe you can speak to this. One of the things that I see in terms of that Venn diagram between art and science is this need for planning and need for experimentation and creativity, right? That there's that you have to plan really well, and you have to be open to those opportunities when they avail themselves to you in the world. So can you talk about those two perspectives, Lauren, and how that plays into, you know, I would think that some incredible experimentation has to go on with your work, but that you also have to be sort of open to when an opportunity arises.
Yeah, and science, a lot of the work is, you know, the whole 99%, let's see, not 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. So, I mean, that's true, I think, in the creative arts as well as science and engineering, is we have an idea, and then you got to like do a lot of work to get it to do it. And so from the point of view of things like drones and working with people at IUPUI, there's a lot of science actually that's done with drones. And so we've been talking about the artistic part of it, but for example, a couple of examples, the geology department does surveys over the lakes and nearby lakes to see about algal blooms and things like that. So you can take a lot of interesting mapping of the lake. And of course, we talked before about the amount of time you can be flying, and you have to stop every 15 minutes and change batteries. When you're over a lake, you got to be careful. You got to be really careful and make sure you change the batteries and bring the drone back when it needs to be recharged. And then another sort of interesting sort of mix of, and one of the reasons I talked about the 3D built environment and then using that to make a model. I have a collaborator here at IUPUI that Professor William has done a lot of work in putting together 3D models from drone and other photography. He goes every year to Greece, where they're doing some archaeology, and as they uncover the stuff in the archaeology, they go take a drone flight around and then use that to create a 3D model in 3D environment back here at IUPUI, and then they can use that for, you know, showing people what the city would have looked like, you know, in the ancient times. And so all of that is really, to me, it sort of sparks my interest, but it takes a lot of work to do as well to connect those things. So I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, I think there's two aspects that all of you are talking about. One is the incredible amount of preparation it takes to be able to do any of the art that we do. People, I think they forget that the art part of it, and same way in science, that, you know, that we are doing a whole lot of prep work so that we can be flexible if we see something along the way. But the other one that occurs to me, and this is really interesting, is perspective. And so I think when I was in Chicago and I was working on building exhibits, we tried an experiment where, this was really early before drones, but we used dirigibles that were filled with helium. And they knew when to go back and dock and charge their battery. But the cool thing was, in that era, the museum had planes hanging in the ceiling. all you could see was the bottom of a plane, which is what you normally would see. What was cool about these was people could actually get and see from the perspective of up there into the cockpit, into something. And so the reason I bring that up is what you guys are talking about is sometimes it's that change of perspective that you can't get as a person walking that makes drone photography. And Paul, I would think that's where that little tiny bit, you don't use it a lot, but when you use it, it's for that perspective. Am I right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, my, you know, my 24 to 70 and 72 to 200 are my bread and butter lenses. But, you know, for a full meal, you need some spices, and my wide angle lenses and the drone are the spices that help liven up the story.
I think there's also something about the motion too. It can give the person that's watching a more sense of motion. We had a drone group come and do. We were doing some work for Toyota that was taking a car and using a kind of a crash test dummy, and using the pedestrian detection in the car to try and figure out whether they were detecting the pedestrians or not. We were doing the science around that. But a crew came in and they took some drone footage. And the most interesting piece of that footage was they actually took it from the perspective of the car, the drone coming toward the pedestrian. And that really showed you, you know, so how crazy it feels to be driving in a car running at a pedestrian at full speed. So there's also perspective in the motion of the drone that you might not get in another medium.
Yeah, and I guess that goes to the heart, all of you are saying, that goes to the heart of what we call the arts, which is that you go off somewhere. And I firmly, and Krista knows this, but I firmly believe that scientists are creatives, and that it doesn't always proceed exactly as planned. And it's sometimes in the mistake or in the weird place that it goes that we make the discovery. And I would think that is the real overlap between art and science, as both people are creatives. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, and I would also say it's that inspiration piece too, that creating something from nothing, right? So both engineers and scientists create something from nothing, and so do creative people. So, I think there's people try to do left brain, right brain things, and I think there's more mixed brain in all these things than we think.
Well, the research is actually there. Joe, go ahead. Sorry.
My film teacher in college always said filmmaking is problem solving. It's not, you know, there are creative aspects obviously, but you're just trying to figure out how to do what you need to do. And you try things, some things fail, and then other things work. And I mean, that's why, you know, they talk about the cutting room floor. You cut a lot out of a video or a film or whatever you're making, and you know, you end up with that small percentage of what you shot. So it is a lot of trial and error. It's a lot of experimentation. And I think that drones, they have just added more, like another tool to kind of experiment and find the angles that you want, find that interesting perspective that they add. So.
What I think also what came out, just what you were talking about, Joe, with all of you, you know, you're talking about the cutting room floor. Which is an old term for when we actually had film in there. And what I think is interesting for all of you, I've been curious, how did the technology of being able to shoot as much as you want, because you can fill cards, right? How did that alter when you had to be really judicious about, because it was expensive to buy the film, develop the film. I know for you, Paul, as a film photographer, if you did it originally film and then digital, it's really hard. You wouldn't know what you were even getting.
Yeah, that's right. I felt like I've done photography since high school, starting with film. And it wasn't until digital that I really dove into it, because Film photography feels like I'm wearing gloves, like I'm trying to, you know, play the violin, but with gloves on. And with digital photography, I felt like I was really playing the guitar. Like it became music for me, that that there was much less in between me and making a photo, a compelling photograph, which I really, that process, I just love it. The technology in drones is just another, it's just pulling away more layers that, I have to be careful, of course, I have to watch what I'm doing, but the drones these days are so smart that I can really get down to the art of making photographs rather than the, you know, the job of having to manage this flying expensive piece of equipment. It really changed a lot for me. Yeah.
And science and engineering has a similar abstraction level thing, that as we've gotten smarter about how to design things, we've been able to abstract away from the nitty gritty of, you know, this transistor goes here and that one goes there, to higher levels. And so that helps us be creative faster too.
So I was looking up, I'm sorry that I'm looking away from the camera. There's a quote. Does anybody know this quote that I don't remember who said it, but about photographing, not what something is, but what else it is. Maybe it's Dorothea Lange.
Sounds familiar.
That just got me thinking about how the drones allow me to find a new, like what else it is. Like I'm often approaching a subject and you know, for me, it's often a lot of nature detail stuff. And the art for me is a lot about, you know, it's asking questions, right? Like, where's the compelling photograph here? This is something interesting. Is this the right angle? Is that the right angle? And now with a drone, I've got another angle to bring in. Like, is this the right way to express this idea, to make this idea more compelling?
That's great. Well, I'm going to nerd out on that for just a second. I'm a qualitative researcher. So I collect stories and narratives as a tool to help us gain new knowledge. And one of my favorite faculty members when I was in my PhD program used to say that the job of qualitative researchers was not to ask what is here, but what is not here. And I think that as we think about, again, this space of creativity and discovery, that a lot about discovery and a lot about being able to build something new is that that negative space to ask about kind of what's missing. So that's a really, really cool quote. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, sure.
With all that, all this creativity, all the thought about the technology and all that integration, it just helps remind us that the Da Vinci Pursuit is here to bring together artists and scientists and members of the community to engage in conversations like what we're doing today. And we're hoping that you at home will explore the intersections between art and science and have some conversations with people based on what you've heard today. We'll be right back after this break.
This is Dave Baghdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee. Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation about the art of drone photography, perspective, visual storytelling, and the technical aspects of drone photography. So it might be a good place to start there. Lauren, I know that you've done a lot of research and you're kind of thinking about the history of drone photography and kind of what the future holds in terms of the technology. Can you tell us a little bit more about that evolution?
So I think the starting point was, you know, a joystick, right? So the pilots basically had a joystick and they directed the drone almost, you know, by twitch, right? So every twitch you made, then the drone would twitch. And the things that have been added to it in the last few years are basically looking at having GPS loaded on the drone, and the GPS will also keep track of a space where it is, and then you can also plan a space in 3D outdoor space. And then once the GPS is added, you can do more stabilization of the camera itself, and then you can do different patterns around those GPS locations. And then the next step is looking at location and mapping the SLAM that I talked about at the beginning, where you can, the drone can kind of know what its environment is and then avoid obstacles that it knows about. And then there's sensors that have been added also to do obstacle avoidance. Really understanding that the drone starts to understand itself in 3D space, where before it was just the pilot had to understand the 3D space. And so if the drone understands a little bit more about the 3D space and the obstacles that are in its environment, it can behave more naturally as the camera moves around. The other thing somebody mentioned also was just the audio from the drone perspective. You put more more microphones on the drone, you can point the audio receiving in any different direction, and so you can avoid some of the sound of the drone propellers. And also propellers have gotten quieter and all that stuff. So that's where things are going from just a Twitch joystick before.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of that development. Even, you know, we weren't on the cutting edge of it necessarily, but we got one of the earlier models of a drone. And even on that one, I can remember you actually had to adjust the trim on it so it wouldn't like drift sideways or turn while it was hovering in the air. So there were physical manual things you had to do to make sure that it was stable. And but now, you know, like you said, with GPS, it just does that itself. It doesn't require any work from my end. And another thing that is really cool is they've integrated motion tracking. So you can select, say you've got a person standing in a field, I could select that person and the drone will actually follow them walking through the field. So that kind of stuff is pretty mind blowing. And, you know, you could definitely recreate that manually, but it would be much more difficult. So.
And I think the gimbal mounts are a pretty amazing technology too, when you're outside and it's a breezy day and you watch the drone fluttering as it's fighting to stay stable. And the image you're getting or the video you're getting, the feed is just rock solid. It's really amazing to see. And sometimes it can be surprisingly windy, surprisingly breezy, and you're still getting a super solid image. It's pretty funny to see, because you can watch the drone shaking as it's fighting to stay in place. And you couldn't tell that at all by the video feed.
You know, that's really interesting, Paul. I, like many, many of our viewers right now during this time, you know, I have a Peloton and that's the way I do my exercise. Mm-hmm. And I'll go out where they've photographed, right? And recently, and it's not because of a drone, but Joe, to your point, gimbals and the way those were used and the way that physics works, you're with somebody that's running, right? And jumping over rocks and stuff. But the film doesn't do that. You know, I mean, the film stays even because somehow the camera is always, you know, being balanced. Do you find that you have it, that was there before we had drones using that kind of technology? Is that helpful to stabilizing the photographer?
Specifically in drone work?
No, in either one, or regular videography or.
Yeah. Yeah, that's been a huge technological advancement that I've gotten to witness too, is that the gimbal coming out and becoming widely used. I mean, that changed a lot of things. Even, you know, Steadicam has been around since the 70s, I think. And it's similar technology, but it's more based on balance and weight, counterweights and things like that. There's a lot more of that involved, and not so much the I don't even know the mechanical stabilization that's going on with a gimbal. I don't fully understand the technology, but even now, like Steadicams, which have been a thing for years, decades, now they've incorporated some of the same technology as gimbals to take the more organic kind of freeform look of a Steadicam and add that extra layer of stability. And with drones, yeah, like Paul was saying, I mean, it's incredible to watch, to see the footage you've gotten on like he said, on a windy day. I've walked around with the drone filming and just held the drone and gotten into some tight spaces that I couldn't fly into. And you would never know that it was just me hand holding this camera. The gimbal technology is pretty, pretty phenomenal.
Yeah, and there's also a vibration and shake reduction that you can do in the image space as well. And people's cell phones do that now.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, we have the advent of really, and I know, Paul, this affects you too, but the advent of really smart lenses now. Some of the new lenses that are out have all kinds of, what I would assume, Lauren, is based on technology that's a software-based technology that's detecting inside the lens itself and correcting for any movement.
Yeah, I mean, you can do a lot. You need to have a good starting point. So I'll have that caveat. Once you have enough pixels and enough resolution as a starting point, you can do a lot of interesting stuff. It's in the camera, in the post camera domain, or in the camera itself. A lot of the cameras will have some of these things built in the image pathway. So like the anti-shake or anti-vibration, it's pretty easy to fix right at the output of the camera.
I'd want to go back to one thing that you kind of started us out with, Rocky, and that was, I'm really interested in the idea of the story. I think we'd be remiss in ending the show having it only be the technology or the creativity of the drone. But telling the story, can you describe more what you mean by telling a story as a videographer?
Well, Joe's the videographer, the cinematographer.
Cinematographer.
I think, and so as a director, that's almost all I try to do is focus on the story. And, you know, the thing that comes to my mind first, because it was fresh off the top of my mind just yesterday, we were out filming. And so apologize, I'll go off track just a little bit here. And there's not a drone involved in this, although Joe was flying the drone out and about, but this particular story, doesn't involve a drone shot, but we were sitting and talking with our subject. We were on a farm. We were in a hoop house where she was picking greens that were going to go to the farmer's market this weekend. And I was interviewing her, just asking her questions as I always do, you know, and this goes back to Paul, that great quote that you shared about not necessarily taking a photo of what something is, but what, you know, or from a different angle. What was it again? Jump back in. What was that quote? I got to look that up.
Not photographing just what something is, but what else it is.
Yes. So what else it is. That's the piece, because, and this story popped into my head when you said that, because there were all kinds of things, and that's what happens. Oftentimes I'm just asking questions of people, finding a story, and I'm oftentimes getting who they are. But I'm digging and looking for who else they are. And this is just the coolest thing. And this happens a lot. Joe knows that while we're out, we just have to listen for these little tidbits. And this one was pretty obvious, but she stops mid-sentence and she goes, "Hold on, shh, listen, do you hear that?" And we were hearing this squawking sound from outside of the hoop house. And she goes, it's the sandhill cranes. She said, the sandhill cranes are flying overhead. And she said, it happens every spring. And when we're out here at the farm and we're picking or planting or whatever we're doing, and the sandhill cranes fly overhead, we know that it's time for spring. And the warmer months are coming, and the harvest, the harvest is when the sandhill cranes are flying over in the other direction. And so she told us this whole story, and we run out, we all go out and we're looking up in the sky, and it took us a little bit and we waited patiently, but we got footage of these sandhill cranes flying over their farm. And to me, I think that's story. Story is listening. And I love that quote. I'm definitely going to look it up. I would encourage listeners who are interested in the story piece to look that up, because that is hugely important. And I think now, to kind of bring it all back and to kind of nerd out a little bit on the science piece of it, to me, that goes back to the scientific method, Mark. You know, you're talking about scientists and scientific method. My 13-year-old is studying scientific method right now. I read a rough draft of his report the other night. And this idea that scientific method is all about testing over and over and over again. A lot of people, maybe if you haven't really studied science or you skipped that scientific method part in the fourth or fifth or sixth grade or whatever, you don't realize that scientists don't run a test. They run hundreds of tests. And then they have peer testing where peers go and they run tests. And what they're looking for, not necessarily is, once again, what something is, but what else it is. And they're looking for that that evidence that this theory that they have, this hypothesis that they'd like to prove is in fact there. And I think that to me is story. And it is. It's scientists running tests and looking for that that proof for their hypothesis, but it's also somebody like me asking somebody questions and then finding that really incredible little nugget and moment where something special happens.
Trying to be open for the unexpected.
Absolutely. I think we're often looking for the hook, right? Like a really great song has a hook that just really brings you in. A good story has that hook that's just, and a good photograph, right? Has a hook. It's got a, an emotional subject or a really great composition that just draws you in. It's always about finding that compelling reason to keep people engaged.
Yeah. And I think anytime you can use a drone specifically or any other camera method that might be different from the rest of the film, or anytime you can use that to enhance the story is awesome. And that's I think that is what makes it worth doing. So.
And I do think just to throw this out there, just to kind of pat all the human beings on the back here, that is, as much as we appreciate the AI and the GPS built into our drones to be able to keep us from crashing into a tree, that choice, that decision to hear and to notice that unexpected or that something else is a very human thing. And I think that it might take a while before we've programmed AI to identify those anomalies. And maybe it's not impossible, but I think it's a very human trait to be able to notice those little special things.
Noticing is the key word I use for my art photography when I'm out in the world, out in the woods, just not really have a plan. I'm just out noticing.
This has been a real thrill for me to have this conversation with you. Thank you all so much for this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome.
You'll find pictures of all of our guests' projects and perspectives on the Da Vinci Pursuit website at thedavincipursuit.com, where we create museums without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can come together to enjoy unique activities and conversations.
And until then, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again next week when we explore more curiosities from the intersections of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedavincipursuit.com.